The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Everyone is invited to this table. Doesn't matter what your religion or your background. I believe that there is sanctity in all life. I believe that everyone deserves to live a long and healthy life, and that's what we try to do each day. 15 hours of live broadcasting a week. And today, we have a two-hour special. Now, my guest for the second hour is now on a plane, and therefore we will reschedule him for next week. And hence, I will hold my thoughts about what I consider a very unfortunate way that we have examined the withdrawal of our troops from Iraq, at least some of our troops, and not looked at the larger picture. So I will definitely today be doing a commentary in our second hour from Tom Engelhardt, from Tom Dispatch, on whose hands, whose blood, killing civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. Also today, in keeping with our efforts to challenge Monsanto, and Michael Taylor specifically, and the Obama White House and members of Congress on supporting the shift towards virtual monopoly of all seeds in the United States to a genetically engineered seed, we will be doing a commentary from F. William Indall on Doomsday Seed Vault in the Arctic. Bill Gates, Rockefeller, and the genetically modified organism giants know something we don't. Well, today you'll know that as well. I will be taking a lot of calls today. I'm sure many people in the audience have issues and thoughts and questions they'd like to share, and we'll give you an opportunity to do that. And my guest in the show this first hour, in about 14 minutes, will be Gerald Celante. And I will pick up where I left off by asking Gerald about issues that impact Americans now and in the near future. So that's what we have, a lot of good. And then this Sunday evening, I will be sharing a whole lot of answers to a whole lot of questions from people in this audience. So Sunday night, 8 p.m., live and streaming. And you can watch today's show by going to GaryKnoll.com. Lives destroyed by happy pills. As our use of antidepressants doubles in a decade, experts say thousands are being given dangerous drugs they don't need, by Jeremy Bourne. And here's this, and I thought this was important, because it ties into a documentary I'm producing now. It's a sequel to The Drugging of Our Children, and this is pathologizing our children. Clara Morgan was going through a rocky patch. Her long-standing relationship had hit difficulties, and she was struggling financially. But she was a self-described optimist, and she felt she was managing and able to cope. Then the 35-year-old biologist started experiencing unusual symptoms. Out of the blue, she said, I felt agitated. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't sleep. I felt very shaky. Now, yes, I'd been under a lot of stress, but my symptoms seemed too odd for that to be the whole explanation. After about 6 weeks of this, she went to see her doctor, who diagnosed depression and anxiety. I asked him if he was sure. Was there anything else that could be causing these symptoms? My weight loss, vomiting, diarrhea. But he said, no, it was depression, and he prescribed antidepressants. Increasing numbers of people are taking antidepressant drugs, with prescriptions doubling over the past 10 years. Unfortunately, this only made this woman feel worse. She developed the shakes as well as suicidal thoughts. attempt to remedy this, her doctor changed the medication 3 weeks later, gave her a different drug at higher doses. Nothing changed. And after mentioning her suicidal thoughts to her doctor, she was put under the supervision of a mental health team. 6 weeks later, Claire was put on yet another antidepressant along with a tranquilizer and an antipsychotic drug. She was now sleeping 14 hours a day, unable to work. She had to rely upon her boyfriend for support. She said, "I was zombified, but still felt the anxiety and terror, and it just didn't seem right. However, my doctors simply increased my drugs." After 6 miserable months, Claire's doctors admitted the drug treatment wasn't working and suggested electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy. I said no way and decided to come off the antidepressants. This proved incredibly hard, worse, actually, than being on them. The only good part was a brilliant nurse who took me seriously when I said I had always felt that something physical had caused my symptoms and put me in touch with a sympathetic private doctor. 1.5 years after her symptoms began, Claire was diagnosed with an overactive thyroid and a problem with her adrenal glands. That's why I had been so bizarrely agitated, had diarrhea, and had lost weight. Claire's story is extreme, but it is far from unique. Increasing numbers of people are taking antidepressant drugs, with prescriptions doubling, and according to a new report, millions, tens of millions of people are taking them on a regular basis. While this rise is partly being blamed on the recession, experts are concerned that misdiagnosis is a major factor. Indeed, a study published recently in The Lancet found that the average medical doctor will wrongly diagnose 16 out of every 100 patients they see with depression and anxiety. So, please keep in mind that if you're feeling out of sorts, if your body's going through different symptoms that it normally would not, don't assume that it's just depression or anxiety and get on drugs. See a complementary or holistic nurse practitioner or a holistic physician so that you can be properly diagnosed and hence properly treated. Pre-crime. Try pre-diagnosis and pre-drugging. Now, what I'm sharing with you now is a section of my new film. And this is just an overview. It also aligns with the CCHR, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, that does good work in the same field. And it is my absolute conviction, based upon the evidence that I see, that the pharmaceutical industry, working behind the scenes with major legislators of both parties and with virtually all the top people in the National Institute of Mental Illness, have been able to come to a place that I had hoped we never would be. In order to prevent crime, you have to diagnose someone who has no symptoms and then drug them. In effect, preemptive medication, preemptive diagnosis. It sounds insane. But a new study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry and headed by a psychiatrist, John Gilmore, professor of psychiatry and director of the UNC Schizophrenia Research, claims to be able to detect brain abnormalities associated with schizophrenia risk in infants just a few weeks old. I would like to point out the obvious flaw in this, what I consider completely fraudulent study. There is no medical or scientific test in existence anywhere in the world that schizophrenia is a physical disease or a brain abnormality. That's just for starters. So let us be clear. No matter what your psychiatrist, psychologist, or physician tells you, as a academic scientist, as a clinician, I will tell you and debate anyone at any point on any issue when they say that there is a way to determine in an infant that they're going to have a schizophrenia or bipolar depression. It is all quackery. It is nonsense. But that won't stop them from going forward. They'll say, oh, well, there's a chemical imbalance. there's not a single study to prove a chemical imbalance test, or x-ray, or MIR, MRI, or any other test for schizophrenia, not one. So with no evidence of medical abnormality to start with, the associated with schizophrenia risk amounts to what George Orwell called doublespeak, language that deliberately disguises, distorts, misleads. It means what? It means zero. From the CCHR, for decades, psychiatrists and pharma have spouted lines to the press and public amounting to researchers now believe they have medical evidence of schizophrenia as a physical biological abnormality, or new evidence suggests evidence of schizophrenia as a real disease. It's all nonsense. Despite millions of dollars in research funds and countless tales of belief, no evidence, nothing, zero, not a scintilla of evidence exists in the scientific literature to support their theories. And one of the most common tricks employed by the psychopharmaceutical industry is to mislead the public and legislators and the press, is to take x-rays or brain images of people who have been long-term users of antipsychotic drugs known to cause brain atrophy and shrinkage, and then claim people with schizophrenia have smaller brains. They've spouted similar studies on kids with ADHD having smaller brains, but the bottom line is that that study was on kids who had been on drugs, and they were smaller kids with smaller brains. And by the way, they didn't tell you that a lot of the kids they take, there are smaller kids, just physically smaller. These are just a few of the PR spins employed by the psychopharmaceutical industry to try to maintain the belief in psychiatry. Psychiatry is not a legitimate science. Psychiatry in the hands of those who are most gifted would be in psychoanalysis and the analysis and discussion with the patient of the issues in their life. There it has benefit. But then again, that's no different than a good holistic psychologist or a good psychotherapist. Or for that matter, your priest or rabbi having a good quality conversation with you. It does not mean that there's anything wrong with your brain or that there's a chemical imbalance. The logical question the press should be asking is, what are the American Journal of Psychiatry and the director of the UNC Schizophrenia Research really after? What is their goal? As you have heard on many of my programs and watched in my documentaries, I have exposed the dark side of psychiatry. Now in my new program, it's even going further. You will see me going... Well, what you will see, and I'll only tell you a little bit, I don't want to let too much of it out, but you will see filming inside doctors' offices, psychiatrists' offices, and you will see them diagnosing a completely normal staff person as having all forms of psychiatric disturbance, and each and every case given a different psychiatric medication. Then you will see those same people confronted on the street and completely unperturbed by the fact that they diagnosed a normal person as having a psychiatric disorder and then give me a prescription. That's the entire field. So what they're doing is they're trying to make us believe that they have signs that they can tell us, link people to causing further problems. So look where they can take that. They'll start making it mandatory for having all young children diagnosed with a screening mechanism that is bound to have at least 40 to 50% of them that fall into the category of potentially problem children, and then getting them on drugs. And then they sure will be problems. It's all about money, creating another income stream for the pharmaceutical industry. And that is unfortunate. Let us be honest. Psychiatry today, at least the pharmaceutical and electroconvulsive part of psychiatry, is a complete and total failure. Institutionalizing patients is a failure. They are definitely doing nothing more than lobotomizing patients and keeping them warehoused. It is a failure. Modern psychiatry took the wrong track when it embraced the idea that the mind should be treated with drugs. But that is the history of psychiatry today. So if you are asked to have a teen screen done, reject it. And let your legislators know that you're opposed to mandatory testing to prevent crimes against society, to help the young people not end up in jail, because you can diagnose criminal behavior early on. No, you can't. And criminal behavior doesn't come from a defective gene, and it doesn't come from a brain chemical imbalance. It comes from the myriad of conditions that arise when we don't pay attention to the environments in which people live, and how they live, and who they live with, and what input they've had. All those multiple factors must be considered. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us.
The girl's got plenty good loving. Ask me how I know, and I'll tell you so. Used to be my girl. I respect her when she was mine. I used to neglect her.
I'd like to welcome everyone from all over the world, and we have a lot of people all over the world listening. I'm Gary Noll. My guest is Gerald Salante. Gerald was on with us just a week ago, and we asked him about the world economy, where he believed it would be heading, and also about the United States economy. He is back. We have more time today with him, and nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Oh, it's always great being on with you, Gary. Thank you for having me.
And, Gerald, what I would like to do today, if you would please, when we go into an area, if you have it available or if you're aware of it, could you give us any of the research or references that you are using in order for your group to come to its decisions? And I also think it's important for people to know that Gerald is not just one person, but rather he has a whole consortium of individuals from around the world who are experts in their field, who are progressive experts, and who are scholars and researchers. And they meticulously review the scientific literature, the trends, the patterns, and they don't just come to a flippant position. It is well-researched, and that's why in more than 85% of the statements they've made in their trends journal, and in public statements, they have been accurate. And just as a point of reference, it was 3 years and 2 months ago, before the crash, when we were at the height of the stock market, and the housing market in some areas had gone up 300%, that Gerald on the show said that we will have a crash in the housing market, in the credit market, and commercial real estate market. I added that we would also see a crash in the hedge fund market and in the equity partnership market. All of that has actually occurred, but we were very specific. It wasn't a general statement. Today we're going to be as specific as possible. Gerald, I want to start and just I want to hold our focus on one point at a time. I was just up in the South Bronx this week filming. I'm filming a new feature film called People Before Profits. And it's the face of the new poverty in America. Now, I spend the opening first 8 minutes of my film focusing upon poverty as we have historically known it. And whether it's Selma, Alabama, or Cottonwood, Alabama, down Louisiana, different places in Appalachia, I show what has been there. Then I show historically the poverty from the 1930s. But then I show the new poverty, the new homelessness, how many Americans are affected. So when it comes to talking about the economy, and we've got the economy turning around and it's doing great and all this, I break that into segments. I was able to do an analysis, and I found that there's approximately 1,200 billionaires, but there are another approximately 1,000 people who have wealth between 500 to $1 billion. Those are the super wealthy. Then we have 8 million millionaires, and we have approximately 40 million Americans who are upper middle class, who tend to be more conservative financially. A high percent of them are either approaching retirement or living in gated communities, and they're going to be okay. So if you add all those up, you're dealing with about 50 million Americans. So their life, that what they see each day, how they go through a day, will not be substantially different. They'll be living in fairly protected environments because there'll be security and services, social services and other services, so that you would look out a window and you wouldn't see a big difference. You go to a restaurant, no big difference. Then we go to another economy, the economy of the strained working class. These are people who are working, but their take-home pay is not adequate to meet their credit card bills, their mortgages. Many of their mortgages are underwater, and as a result, they are in crisis and facing the prospect of losing their homes. Many will lose their jobs, or their jobs will be reduced in hours. Then you have the extremely stressed working class. These are people where one of the parents is not working. Their children are frequently living back at home, even those out of college or a little later in life. They are frequently losing their homes. They are living with relatives or other individuals, and they're living under conditions that they would never have thought possible just 2, 3, 5 years ago. Those two groups together are about 150 million Americans. And about 20 million of those are children under the age of 18. And then you have the poor class. And within the poor class, you have a lot of senior citizens living on limited Social Security and some pension, and some no pension, just Social Security. And they're virtually invisible. You do not see them. They do not have a contingency. They don't have a political base. And then you have the poor that we see out on the streets, and you see the poor in the ghettos. And those are the poor that most people think of. Well, when you add all those up, you're now at about 260 million Americans. That's a lot of people. So it's not one economy. It's multiple economies. It's at least 7 to 8 different economies. And when I travel around the United States, I'm seeing more and more of the stressed working and middle class that no one's helping them. Now, the word I get back from them is that they spend less at the mall, they spend less money, and yet they're being told to get the economy going, they got to spend. And these people are smart enough now to start paying down their debts, saving as much as they can, because they don't trust the future, they don't trust the politicians, and there's no third party that they really want to support. A lot of them would have supported the Tea Bag Party, but they see how fractionalized and how stupid some of the leaders were and racist, and how Republicans and Sarah Palin and others tried to co-opt it. So they're waiting for a third party. But many were former Democrats and liberals. Many were also Republicans, and they don't trust those systems. So I'd like for you to now address what you see in the short term, meaning in the next 12 months, the long term, the next 3 years, happening to the groups I just mentioned in the United States as far as safety, gangs, quality of life, social services, the things that allow a community to exist. One final caveat. Last week, I took my annual little sojourn, and I spent a lot of time up in the mountains of Arizona, north of Flagstaff, much higher. That's 7,500 feet. I was up much higher. But on my way back, I stopped off in Sedona. And Sedona is one of those little idyllic communities, or at least it environmentally it certainly is, and they have a health community there. And I heard about how the town closest to it, which is a pretty good sized town, Cottonwood, is filled with gangs. The drugs and violent crimes and breaking and entering are rampant, and now it's coming into Sedona, which historically had withstood every kind of financial crisis and other social upheaval, and quality of life has diminished there. I looked at every other mall had closings. I saw empty houses. A lot of people are financially struggling, and it's happening there as well. Then I was talking with friends who had been in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos. It's happening all over the place. Quality of life is now suffering. Those are my concerns. I'd like to hear your point of view, please.
Well, as the economy goes, so too will go the quality of life. And the quality of life in the United States, if we stay on the path that we're on, politically, socially, spiritually, and economically, the standard of living is going to continue to decline dramatically. The days of the great American middle class are virtually over when you look at the numbers. And you could go back, and this isn't rhetoric, it's fact. And the fact is that median household income right now as we speak is lower than it was back in 1998. And we've been on a steady downhill decline. It's been going down for some time, since the Vietnam Wars, actually. And it escalated the decline, beginning with NAFTA, that great hoax that was perpetrated by Bill, the Republican in sheep's clothing, Clinton. And they promised us, and it's amazing that they're never held to their feet for these forecasts and promises, that our standard of living would go up. And the fact of the matter is, it's gone down. We've lost, even since Bush has been president, 5 million manufacturing jobs. And they replaced it with that big lie of the wonderful service sector jobs. And when you break out the word service, what are you left with? Servitude, servant, serfs. And we've gone from a nation of merchants, of craftsmen, of manufacturers, of mom-and-pop businesses, to ones of now clerks, cashiers, shelf stockers, home health aides. And that's where the jobs are being created, by the way. So they're all low-paying jobs, even though they're not creating those either. We just saw the new first-time filers for unemployment. And I love the language they use. They're greater than expected. The number came in higher than expected. Expected by whom? We've been saying this all along. There's no recovery. It happens in the numbers. You look at the numbers. The numbers are there. And they're cooking the numbers at that. Because we only have an unemployment rate of, according to the official numbers, 9.5. Because under the criminal Clinton group, what they did, as you well know, Gary, once you're off the unemployment rolls, you're no longer counted as unemployed. How could they get away with this stuff? And so what we're looking at, again, current events form future trends. What do we do? Here's what I do each day. I read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. I read the hard papers, because when reading a whole paper, if you're not reading newspapers, you're not tracking trends. Sorry, it's a whole different experience reading online. You can't read as much, and you're only reading selectively. You have to read the whole story, socially, economically, politically, globally, the arts, entertainment. And speaking of entertainment, before I go on, if you want to know what's wrong with America, pop culture. We've become snooky stupid. Could you imagine the President of the United States snickering about snooky and making jokes about it? And this person, this little nothing of a person, a caricature, being a big sensation? And it's really emblematic of where the country is. And by the way, she's not Italian, I'm Italian. They're passing her off as an Italian. She's from Chile, and Chile's not Italy. But having said that, we become a nation. When you look at the pop culture, you can see where we're going. So you look at Snooki Stupid, you look at rap, gangster rap. Oh, isn't it wonderful? Look how dumb the people look. Hats on sideways, pants low. Music that, you know, the same, I've been hearing the same stupid beat now until it's been going nuts in my head for the last 15 years. This is who America is for 80% of the population. So in looking at that 80% of the population and being snooky stupid, where are they going for jobs? Well, they're not getting them because there's no manufacturing. How about joining a gang? Current events form future trends. Where do we, You look at the data coming out about how many young kids now in high school are gang-focused, and the numbers continue to escalate because that's the only employment they're going to get. And then we read Al Jazeera, Haaretz, Jerusalem Post, Arab News. We read The Guardian. We read the French newspapers, the Russian newspapers. We read as much global news, trying to get... All we want is the information. We'll come out with our own conclusions. So we use all these different sources. So as we're looking, and as you're talking about your trip to the South Bronx, and you mentioned what you mentioned also about food stamps. What do we have? 40 million people on food stamps? I call them recovery rations. And Obama, when you talk about the unions, he's taken $26 billion to give to the teachers' unions and has taken it away from future food stamps, a good portion of that money coming up in the future years. So what we're looking at is a poverty that we have never seen before. Because when you go back to the Great Depression, people were self-sustaining. They know how to do things. Look at the shape they were in compared to now. The poorer you are, the more obese you are. The more junk food you're eating, the more dead your brain is going. People didn't have that luxury of just sitting around in front of a television and getting dumber by the second. We're going into a depression here, which we're calling the greatest depression. There will be no recovery. There is no recovery. I watched Obama... this past week, you couldn't write a better script unless you were a political hack. They took him to Ohio. And instead of like what the Republicans do, they bring out the blue-collar guy, Joe the Plumber. Oh, no, the Democrat brilliant minds, these spin doctors, they brought out Joe the Architect, both from Ohio, the plumber and the architect, the quiche eater and the hot dog eater. And Obama sat there in the backyard talking to the folks. They always talk about the folks. Well, folks. And they sat around on picnic tables, and Obama said, oh, you know, Joe over here, he hired two new people because of the stimulus program. Two new people? In a country of over 300 million people? 8.5 million jobs lost? And they went on and on. You know what I call this, Gary? Presidential porn. They're trying to convince us that there's going to be an economic orgasm and a happy ending. It's not going to happen. Because when you listen to the words, he said them. He said them out loud. They were trying to create an atmosphere, a cycle of belief in confidence, that so that when businesses have confidence, they'll hire. And that when the consumer has confidence, they'll spend. No, the businesses will hire when they get business, and the consumers will spend when they have money. But you think of the word, he kept going over it and over it, confidence. Confidence. That's the other way, by the way, you track trends. You look for the words. You parse the language. See what it means. Break up the word confidence. Confidence man. There's Obama, the confidence man. Con man. There is no recovery. It's a con. The only people that got the money were the Goldman Sachs gang, the Merrill Lynch mob, the AIGs. You look at the number of the amounts of bonuses that were given, and worldwide, it's a global game. The central bankers are all in this together. So as we're looking to the future, you're going to start seeing the social safety nets torn apart, the quality of life declining rapidly, social services, they're already being eliminated. And the one thing that no one speaks about. How about cutting the defense budget? Oh, isn't it wonderful? They had that wonderful spectacle yesterday. We just took out another 50,000 troops out of Iraq. Yeah, and you're
well, hold on.
To Afghanistan.
I want to save that for a little later on in
okay.
the show. All right?
But we have to look at where the money's coming from.
Okay, let me break this down then. I want to keep us on point here. I have a friend that owns a health food store in Detroit. And my friend said that when I told my friend and her family, I said, I believe you should sell your store. This is 2.5 years ago when I was in Detroit and on a PBS station there, which I've been on, I don't know, a dozen times with different shows. And the driver was the one that tipped me off. Normally, he went a certain route every single time I'd been to Detroit, many times. And this time, he took a little different route. And I said, why are you taking this route? He's just safer. I said, safe from what? I says, daylight. He said, you don't understand what Detroit has become. And I said, what has Detroit become? He said, Gary, in the last couple of years, it's gone downhill substantially, and it's getting worse. And now the people, many of the people are so poor, and many of the people are so desperate. They're burglarizing things in broad daylight. And he shrugged his shoulder. He says, look, I don't blame these people. I'm not condemning them. Because I don't know if I would not do the same thing if my family were starving or I were desperate. But all I know is the problem's not being solved in Detroit. Now, so I talked with my friend about this, and, oh, no, we're in a different neighborhood. You know, that's there, and we're out here and near Grosse Pointe. And, you know, well, last week, robberies in the parking lot of this person's health food store. Customers not able to spend the same amount of money, under a lot of stress. And now suddenly, oh yeah, it's here. Now, then we jump ahead. I'm going to connect these dots. So now I take a look at how many soldiers were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan last year. And it's quite a lot. But you know it's not the same amount that was killed by gangs in Chicago? Last year, Chicago had over 460 gang killings. Not only that, but I didn't realize how many gang members there were in Chicago. There's now 100,000-plus gang members in just the south side of Chicago and the west side of Chicago. Now, those numbers are staggering because, Gerald, 4 years ago when you and I spoke about the rise of gangs and especially the Mexican Mafia at that time and today, the largest gang in the United States, we were talking about there were about 100,000 members. Well, now it's 1.2 million. 1.2 million members of gangs. 10% of those members are former military. Now, here's my concern. Everywhere I'm at, I'm hearing people in every state that I'm at, in every town that I'm at, talk about something they have not seen before in any quantity. They're seeing the erosion of a civil laws. They're seeing crimes committed, cars being stolen, fights. They're seeing brutality. Now, in Summit, New Jersey, considered a very nice town, quiet town, a peaceful town, a bunch of teenagers beat a man to death in broad daylight. That had never happened before. Now, suddenly, what was a quiet and nice town, people are asking, how did this happen? It was just in the news about a guy just shoots a young person. Why? For initiation into a gang. To get into this particular gang, you had to go out and shoot someone and kill them. Before, it was taking a box blade and cutting up someone's face and mutilating them, a woman or a man, to get into the gangs. So now you have people faced with two factions. You have the gangs on the one hand offering money, more often than not from drugs, extortion or kidnappings and robbery as inducements, and on the other you have an increasing level of poverty. Now certain people, based upon their upbringing and their own character and spiritual values, no matter how bad it got, they would not resort to violence or in any way doing anything to another human being that they would not want done to themselves. So they're living, no matter how bad it is, within moral high ground. But that's a relatively small number compared to the amount of gangs we're seeing, even down in Florida, even in a very wealthy community of Naples, probably the wealthiest community per population on the planet. You go out, you just go a few miles out of the downtown area, you're in a lot of trouble because there's a lot of gangs and a lot of crime, and everybody's armed down there. You go to every single house out in Golden Gate, every single person's got guns, and a lot of these are senior citizens who got guns who never had them before, people who didn't want to have guns, but they're afraid to go to bed at night because that's when the people are attacking to get their gold or silver or money. And so now I'm very concerned that we're not paying attention about the gang problems in America. It is spreading everywhere. There is no place immune, and yet it is not on anyone's talking points. We don't hear it in the political discussions. We don't see it in the media. And yet if you track it, and if you're where I'm at ground zero. I'm going into communities and speaking with people. When I was up in the South Bronx the other day, a man, a very articulate man, said this to me. He said, "Gary, take a look at all these buildings. There are thousands of empty stores because the landlord wouldn't negotiate a decent rent with the owners, and they went out of business. You have empty apartments, yet you have homeless people on the street. What does it say about a city's politics when they allow people to be homeless when they could be living in an environment, and but they don't do it?" He said, "This is the problem. The politicians will come here when they want to get elected, and we never see them again. And yet everything continues to go down." He says, "Look at this street." He said, "We used to get the garbage picked up all the time. Now you don't see it." And then when I was going across Fordham Parkway, there was in one street, and it really struck me, there was a I'm going to say a 10-foot long and 5-foot wide makeshift table that had cut up watermelon. I mean, hundreds of pieces of watermelon cut up, and then pineapple cut up, and mangoes peeled. And that's because someone got an idea to sell these fruits and make some money. I support that. You would never see that on the Upper West Side or anywhere else in Manhattan. You'd get a ticket, you'd be fined, or your stuff be confiscated. But now, there's almost a rule of the streets going on in areas of the city that do not that realize that if you go shutting down everyone who wants to make a living out on the street, and then another block, I saw another person doing it. It's like they moved the bodega out onto the street. And then I saw a whole rash of little tiny trucks selling fish and other trucks selling produce. But they were kind of parked half on the sidewalk and half in the street. Now, no one normally would say that's anything. So what? So what? And I'm saying, so what? Pay attention to the little things, because that's showing you the basic structural breakdown within a society. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it's all over. I mean, it's in every sector. I mean, you're right on the money with this. The country's going broke in every possible way. Look, you're a kid. You grew up with a family, and your mother's, you know, on crack or whatever else, and you don't know who your father is. You're not graduating high school. Yeah, what are you going to grow up to be? And this is what this is what this country has to wake up to. And all this baloney about, you know, they have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Let's make this really clear. The only way all of these guys are multi-billionaires and worth hundreds of millions is because they're doing an inside deal with a club. They're not doing it on their own. And so we have all these kids out there that are growing up helpless and hopeless and on drugs that we never dreamed about. Forget the, you know, I mean, with the place across the street from me, a little coffee shop over here, it's gotten broken into twice in the last 8 months. For what? For $10 to buy some crack that the guy maybe left some change in the cash register. As you said, they're breaking in broad daylight. They're out of their minds. They have no minds. Their minds are cooked. As I said, current events form future trends. You pick up the headline of the Wall Street Journal. This is August 18th, Wednesday, not too far away. Here's the headline. Scores stagnate at high schools. New data show that fewer than 25% of 2010 graduates who took the ACT college entrance exam possess the academic skills necessary to pass entry-level courses. America's become snooky stupid. the music, the attitudes from the top, by the way, from the we're fighting immoral wars to the people down trying to rip off the system at the bottom. Why should anybody think for one second that they shouldn't get in the good business of crime? Crime pays at the top. Why not have it pay at the bottom? No, this is, and I'm one for, I believe in Second Amendment rights. If I lived in Norway, would I believe that? No. Considering what's going on here, yes, I do. Don't tell me I can't protect myself, because guess what, kiddies? The cops aren't there to protect you. And as far as this becoming a issue of gangs and crime, you wait, Gary. Mark my words, it'll be the major issue of the 2012 campaign. And these same war hawks and war hens that got us into these wars are now going to be saying we have to get tougher on crime. Yeah, like Rudy Giuliani, that really toughy on crime, and you catch his daughter robbing stuff out of a cosmetics store. Boy, did that get out of the news real quick.
A thought for you, Gerald. I want to go from the problem to the solution in five different areas. And by the way, I'm saving Iraq, Afghanistan for the end because I have my own special insight on that. I'm going to share a thought with you based upon what I see as a possible solution, at least done in some place where you can have a model to show it can work. I would like to see in an ideal world, we realize that 80% of all the people who are employed in the United States are employed by small business entrepreneurs. And if we were to give interest-free loans through the Fed and the Treasury to small businesses that qualified, and I would do away, abandon, shut up completely the Small Business Administration. Instead, I would get a group of retired business people who've actually owned businesses, and by categories, by state, so whatever your application was for, there would be a group of at least three people who were expert in that field from firsthand experience themselves, look at your application to see, is it reasonable, do you have a chance of succeeding? If you did, then you could apply for up to $5 million. Now, there would be no interest at all and no payments for 3 years. This gives you an opportunity to at least not be one of those 93% of all businesses that fail because you're undercapitalized in the first year of your existence. Then you have a major criteria. From dollar one of that, for every $1 million that you receive as a small business person, you must employ one person at $20 an hour plus health benefits, which brings up to about $30. That is a living wage. It's not a great wage, but it's a living wage. You can actually, pay some bills with that, better than what a person be making working at one of the jobs you had just mentioned earlier. Now, if you look at how many small business people right now cannot get loans from the Small Business Administration or get loans, no matter what their collateral position is, from banks, and no money was given to the small businesses out of this first TARP plan and the second stimulus plan, totaled together almost $1.9 trillion. And none of that went to small business people. None of it. But if you gave this kind of stimulus, I'm guesstimating, and I pass this by Michael Hudson, who, as you know, is just one of the most brilliant economic minds in the world, I would guesstimate that about 5 million American entrepreneurial-minded people, those who currently have businesses that need to upgrade them and expand them and those that would start them, and that would be across the board. You'd see stimulus in all 50 states. You would see local people hired at good living wages in their local area, and the business would have a chance of surviving because it would be under the same terms. We're not asking for anything special. The same terms they're giving to Goldman Sachs and AIG, zero interest. That's what they're paying. But the first payment starts in 3 years, and then you charge them 2%. Now, let's say that we had 5 million people take us up on this, and they average three million each. That's not an unreasonable amount. That's 15 million. 15 million new jobs. 15 million new jobs. Half of all unemployed would be employed, and you would disperse it across the United States, and the average dollar changes hands in less than 4 weeks and less than 26 hands, and we want to get it to where it stays at least 6 months, and the dollar, that dollar that's earned in the community stays in the community and changes 66 hands. And that's what it was in the 1980s. So that would be stage one. Stage two, that we go into inner cities. We go into every single inner city in the United States. And then we have a developmental plan where you then give a 2-to-1 tax break for corporations to donate to the inner city developments, and the key is to reclaim all these buildings, but on a massive scale where the local population are employed, and then you don't offer them for sale. Instead, you offer them for rent at 15% of the disposable income, which means even the poorest person would then be able to have quality place to live. At the same time, with every building and every block, you also include drug rehabilitation, holistic counseling, to help people who are in crisis, daycare to help mothers who are caring for their children in a good way, but they can't care for the children by paying for the normal daycare and then go to a job because they don't make enough money to do both. So this way it helps them. You can also have charter schools. You could have cultural events. You could have community gardens. In effect, you could create a renaissance in every ghetto in America. You could de-ghettoize America. How many people? And because the government's not paying for it, the taxpayer's not paying for it, and corporations, instead of offshoring $6.3 trillion in their profits, could be bringing it back and getting the tax write-offs, then you could see at least another 5 million Americans positively benefited. Thirdly, you have a regreening of America by planting 15 million green trees and shrub rows in every state in the United States. 2 million people put to work, mainly younger people who right now have the highest level of unemployment. So you're regreening, you're doing the right thing for the environment and water tables. And then you take the military-industrial complex budget, which is now offline and online, including Homeland Security. It's a $1.1 trillion. You bring it down to $200 billion because that's all that's needed by any expert I've queried, and I've done a lot of study on this, a lot of scholarship. $200 billion gives us all that we need to prevent, deter, and to challenge and counteract any military incursion and any emergency against us. That leaves you $900 billion there. You stop all farm subsidies to the major corporation. That's $350 billion. You stop all medical malpractice insurance and all excessive defensive diagnostic procedures, which is almost 50%, that's $300 billion. And you make no-fault medical insurance. So no doctor, nurse, or hospital can be sued, but every doctor and every nurse in the hospital puts 1% of their earnings, 1%, that's all, into a general fund, which then has caps on liabilities, so you deal with all these ambulance-chasing people that look for any opportunity to sue, and that way doctors can get back to practicing quality care. You also have single-payer coverage under Social Security for those who are not covered, which is about 17 million right now, and also you have a national preventative health program that will prevent a lot of diseases and not just treat them. And then you go into the communities, those probably 2-3% of the American population that is not afraid of getting back to the land, and you offer 100 acres of state land for free, and the first year's development, providing that those people grow organically diversified farming for the local community and giving 25% of what they grow free to food banks, so that what you're producing, you can actually help. Those are my ideas of how to help. By what I just said, we would save $2.6 trillion from our governments, and we would be able to get, add the math up, 25 million people back to work. We're going to say goodbye to WMYE, and everyone else can continue to listen to Gerald Salonte and myself by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.